First of all, bon appétit. I hope that the talk will improve your appetite and not reduce it. What I'm going to do is now I shall just continue. What happened? But that was not me. So what I shall do is I will just something to adjust there first.
That's okay.
Yeah. So I'm going to continue at that point where I stopped yesterday. And now I would like to start out here with another experimental investigation of critical Casimir forces. And as you might remember, that I, so to say, scored already twice. That is getting Moses Chen doing the helium experiments and then Peter Pashen carrying out the X-ray scattering for the classical liquids. And now both of them are, so to say, indirect evidences for the critical Casimir forces. You make a detour via wetting films and there thickening or thinning. And then from that you infer indirectly on the action of Casimir forces. And therefore it would be, of course, much nicer to see them directly. And moreover, I told you that colloidal suspensions are very good candidates to generate these Casimir forces by the fluctuations you induce in the solvent, and then they act on the colloidal particles. And if you remember, that was the very early experiment I showed to you by Daniel Besance. And so I really was eager to see, to have a crucial test on that level of the Casimir forces. And now it happens that in the physics department at the university in Stuttgart, there is a group around Professor Bechinger who has a long-lasting experience on handling colloidal suspensions and investigating their structural properties. And you may understand that him being exposed to my sort of talking to him over Casimir forces took a toll after a couple of years, and he finally agreed to make an effort to study them. And so the question is, first of all, what kind of system you would look at? And my suggestion was just try the same system as Daniel Besance was using. That means the same kind of binary liquid mixture as a solvent, because that has, from an experimental point of view, you should appreciate why the experimentalists are keen on having lower critical points, because experimentally it's for them much easier to inject heat into the system than extracting it. That means by heating the sample, you hit then the critical point, and experimentally this is much easier than extracting heat, and this way coming from top to the critical point. So this, and moreover, you want now, you need significant temperature control. We are talking about reduced temperatures, 10 to minus 3, roughly speaking. And this is much easier to achieve if you have a critical point around room temperature, because then heat isolation is, easier to achieve. Moreover, it should be a substance which, chemically is benign, which also turns out to be the case. Many other binary liquid mixtures are somewhat hazardous and so on. So for a couple of reasons, this is the lutidine water is a really suitable solvent. And now the question is whether you would now look at the interaction between two colloidal particles or between a colloidal particle and a wall. And there it turns out that the combination with the wall is very appropriate, because there have been already designed certain experimental techniques to investigate the interaction of colloidal particles with walls. And the tool which seems very suitable is TIRM, which is the total internal reflection microscopy. And the idea you have is the following. You have a sample where the liquid is enclosed here. It's confined by a glass wall here. What you do is you use an optical tweezer to capture a colloidal particle, and the tweezer has the mandate to keep this colloidal particle, in this lateral position. You want to avoid that this particle is floating around laterally. You want to keep it laterally at the defined position. And then, once it's fixed there, you shine in laser light from below the angle of total reflection, such that you have an evanescent intensity leaking into the liquid, which is indicated here, which is going to decay exponentially. And now, this colloidal particle will now perform a dance due to Brownian motion in this intensity field of the laser beam. And it will scatter light which leaks into the liquid. And the scattered intensity you get out from that is an experimental signal which looks like here. And this is the experimental data. And all what I'm going to talk about is how you can make sense out of this noisy data. So the message is that the noise is the message. So the problem is now to infer that. The underlying idea is that you now can, having this fixed laterally, it undergoes Brownian motion in vertical direction. And the intensity of the scattering depends sensitively on the position from the substrate, which means that knowledge about this profile of the intensity enables you to translate this intensity data into data about the distance of the center of the particle from the substrate. And once you have that, this particle samples in a Brownian way the effective potential it will experience with the substrate. Since this is now an extremely dilute system, namely just a single colloidal particle, what you have is then that the probability that this particle is at a certain distance from the substrate is just e to minus beta effective potential. And this way, just by sampling the potential, you can infer the potential. This is the basic idea. Well, now there are one good aspect of that is that this is extremely sensitive, and we need that. So the force resolution is femtonewton, and that really you should appreciate. So this means it's 1,000 times more sensitive than force microscopy. And this brings you up to a level where you can really now expect to get high-resolution data about the forces. Well, there is also a hitch in that. Namely, as you can imagine, this is an optical technique. Now, we are going to approach the critical point in this liquid, and so the liquid will turn turbid. And this is a challenge, because then you are facing the possibility that you're just losing your signal. Because if this is going to, if this laser light now is scattered at the critical fluctuations, then you have just a glowing tube, and your signal from the scattering of the colloid, due to the colloid, is just lost. And this was a discussion I had with Clemens Bechinger for a long time, whether we would succeed to approach the critical point just close enough before you are just going to lose the signal. So we see the incipient forces before you are going to lose them in the critical opalescent liquid. And, well, so we figured out that we might have a chance, and then you try it, and after a lot of playing with all parameters, it worked out. So what you typically see here is that these colliding particles, they are charged, which means that they are repelled from the substrate. On the other side, you have forces acting onto them towards the substrate. This is gravity.
Why they're repelled, the substrate is also charged?
Yes, both are charged, equally same sign, so that it's repelled. And this you see here in this potential, this is the one which is the repulsive part. Now, in the black one, you see an attractive piece, which just varies linearly, which is due to gravity, taking into account buoyancy forces, but in addition also the optical forces due to the tweezer. So you also get a normal force, not only, to say, a holding potential laterally, but you also get a normal force acting on that. And this gives rise to this linear piece, which you can subtract, and you end up with the red curves, and the red curves is, to say, the external potential without the forces you put onto them.
So that curve is experiment?
Yes. This is already experiment.
So that's what logarithm of density plotted as a function? I mean, how is phi is obtained?
This is the potential in units of kBT versus distance.
And the potential was obtained from the probability distribution
yes.
of the...
Here. You go from here to here. Yes. So you have E2 minus beta phi is the intensity distribution, and by taking the logarithm, you get from.
As a kid, why the air is getting thin as you go higher.
Absolutely. It's not. Yeah.
It's the blue one that's the data, and the subtraction of the red one is a corrected one.
Yes, absolutely. The red one is if you subtract this linear piece.
Which means. Carefully, I guess, measuring the density or something like this.
You just.
Z independently.
Oh, maybe the slope is just telling you anyway. It weighs so much.
He's measuring only Z, essentially.
Only Z.
The reflectivity gives him the Z.
Yes.
That's the only thing.
This is translated, as I said, this is translated into telling. The intensity tells you where the particle is relative to the substrate. So if the intensity is low, it means it's far away. If the intensity is high, it means it's close. And therefore, you translate this noisy thing into an average of the average intensity distribution you gain from here is equal to E to minus beta times effective substrate potential.
I think the question is to make sure you're taking out only the gravity. So you're looking at some distance z big, where it's only a gravity distribution.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're deciding where to fit that.
Yeah.
And then coming back.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like you're fitting through that whole set.
But that's one thing. But those forces which contribute to the linear piece are known. In addition, independently.
How do you vary the position of the particle? By changing the charge?
No. Just sitting there and looking. It's just Brown in motion.
Then you know just one or Brown in motion.
Brown in motion.
Okay, sits and admires.
Just, so to say, be patient and watch. So you have a movie.
Just a kind of question, because you know this straight line which you're going to say eventually subtract. It's not really straight, it has some small bump on the right. This is the size of the experimental error which I expect.
Yeah.
That would tell me the size of experimental error.
Yeah, so the error bars
also,
are sign.
After the subtraction, that
yeah,
would be,
yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
would be the
absolutely, error. Absolutely. Yes. Another thing you should. Is there another question?
Just a quick question. How do you measure the evanescent intensity?
No, not at all.
Isn't that how you infer Z?
Yeah, but so to say, that is something you can calculate.
So you exponentially dying intensity, which
this is just.
But then you have to measure it to infer Z.
Reflected wave.
You know what color you're shining
from the
reflection.
Yeah.
So the reflection decreases.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now if we go into this detail, there is also still something to worry about. As I told you, these objects, they undergo critical adsorption. So what you will have is, of course, also a critical adsorption profile emerging here. And that means that the evanescent wave propagates not in a system with constant index of refraction, but the index of refraction, due to the concentration profile you build up here, is inhomogeneous and temperature dependent. So this adds, to say, a twist on that, but we analyzed that too, that this will not perturb our analysis, but it's something you have to consider.
One more question. I'm looking at this graph of noise. And, you know, maybe it's just an illusion, but, you know, you're under a scale of hundreds of seconds. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, you know, what is the scale of the signal fluctuation, but, you know, if I look at this, it looks something like a second. But this is really sampling of Brownian noise. So you have this curve at up to which resolution in time?
Well,
sample the fluctuations of.
Yeah, so you see, you get just an intensity distribution function out of this.
Well, you are not really following. You are just sampling once a second,
yeah,
and that's it.
Well, look, the one you are interested in, it's a very justified question. If you are interested in the critical dynamics of these Casimir forces, then the message about the time dependence is essential. But we are now interested in the static properties, and therefore we do the time average.
So far they have no laws, as far as I learned. And so far, I mean, the time dependence has not, the correlations have not yet been analyzed.
We are sitting on data. Sitting on data.
I just want to make sure something. You're looking at lots of red guys at the same time.
And
lots of colloidal particles.
No. Just a single one.
It's
a single one.
I understand your question about variation.
The point is that we really look at a single particle. My remark was only that, you see, that the issue arises, how do you get access to this intensity profile? And I said, well, this is easy to calculate. You just classical optics. If you have evanescent wave to total reflection, you can calculate this if you know the indices of refraction. Point now is that if you look very carefully at it, that here you don't have the bulk index of refraction constantly up to the surface, and then it switches to the one of the glass. But the index of refraction has now also a Z dependence in it, induced by the fact that you have a critical adsorption profile building up here. That means that the laser beam propagates not in a homogeneous index of refraction, but in one which varies spatially. And this adds a certain complication to it.
But who's adsorbing? You say critical adsorption.
Yeah, so you have here the binary, this is in the binary liquid mixture.
Gotcha.
And this binary liquid mixture has. This is what your favorite question from yesterday.
Obviously, I'm trying to find it every place.
And what I'm saying is that now the optics will be influenced by this concentration profile.
And this is what this is a blue laser. What is it, this light? Is blue laser or what is it?
this is 532 nanometer.
500 nanometer.
500 nanometer, and the power is 2 milliwatt.
Let's get a question. So if I look at this potential without subtracting the gravity, at the minimum it looks like a harmonic potential, and you probably know the mass of this particle. So what is the period of the harmonic motion?
This is just harmonic motion.
It's getting kicked too hard.
Yeah. So.
No. Here's the potential for the particle. Particle has a mass. So if you forget about fluctuations, it has a minimum position.
Yeah. Then it sits there. Then it sits there.
So what is the period?
You don't know time anyway.
So I want to know if it's related to the distance between those little wiggles.
Oh, of course not. Those are seconds.
No.
The magnitude of the interesting part of that is a small fraction of kT.
Excuse me,
The magnitude of the interesting part of that is a small fraction of kT.
Not quite. So you will see it later on. So we shall focus on certain features here. You will see that.
Okay.
You will see that. Okay. Yeah, so are we now have a common base in understanding what the setup is? Okay. And then let me now just jump to the... Now there is one additional piece of information I want to provide to you. And this is also important. If you look at that, if you subtract this... linear piece here, this is really flat here, which means that you do not see dispersion forces. Otherwise, you would have, so to say, here somewhere a potential minimum due to dispersion forces. And we wanted to avoid that because we have then you would have to do more complicated subtraction schemes. And it just happens that now the indices of refraction of the binary mixture and the glass are so close that you basically blind the dispersion forces. And this means that in this business now, we are basically only dealing with the forces due to charge and the critical Casimir forces. These are the two which are in the play. In the game. The other ones are basically eliminated. So this is also an important aspect. Yes. Well, and here we go.
I'm sorry.
Yeah?
It can't be exactly matched because you see. So
there is a bit left. Absolutely, there's a little bit left.
Depending on the separation, like in what frequency range.
Absolutely. So it's not zero, but it's such that in these data, it's not detectable. They are so the contrast is so.
What was the average separation between the surfaces, the sphere, and the plate again?
Pardon?
Was it the Z that was the separation? It's in the micrometer range.
Yes. Yeah, and the particles are, the size of the particles is also 2 micrometer. We have used two different sizes, so we are all in the micrometer regime. Well, and now what we do is, simply speaking, we now monitor this potential as function of temperature. And if now the black ones are cases where you are far away from the critical point, which is, so to say, the baseline, where the Casimir forces are not yet switched on. And so you see that if you are, let's say, beyond this position, out there the potential is basically zero. So, which means that the repulsive electrostatic forces start to act from here. And that means everything what is beyond to the right, that should be due to Casimir forces only. And what you see is now indeed, if you get closer and closer to the critical point, you develop strongly attractive forces, which ultimately, at closer distance, are counterbalanced by the electrostatic repulsion.
What kind of electrostatic repulsion is this? Can you quantify the separation dependence? It's just charges?
Charges, yeah. So
fixed charges.
Yeah, absolutely. And
you can probably adjust the decay of this potential by adding salt.
Yeah, so the bi-length... So we have a certain bi-length, which was, well, I don't have the number now with me, but you can easily infer it from the curve.
The charge that you can infer from these curves on the interacting bodies is the same as a function of temperature? It doesn't change?
That's a possibility.
It does or it doesn't?
Well,
no, temperature range.
So
you measure everything, you measure the superposition of all the forces, but the idea is that you measure for at high temperature, so away from critical point, the kind of, you know, there is no Casimir force yet, so everything is just electrostatic.
Yeah.
You fit it to
exponential
decay,
and then in all the other courses,
which is approximation.
Could you tell me the absence of Casimir forces? I do not understand what kind of potential is it. You have a charged sphere where charge presumably can move on the sphere itself. It can be polarized, presumably. Yeah? And you have a
Well, you see, these are polarized.
Wait.
So these polystyrene particles, so I doubt that the charges are very mobile on its surface.
No, but it has a dielectric constant, so it can be polarized.
Yeah, but they don't move easily. I think they are spatially fixed.
And then you have what I'm supposed to think about the surface. Is it a uniformly charged surface, or why does potential diverge? It's you're approaching with a sphere, you're approaching a flat surface.
Yeah.
Why is there a divergence of potential?
If you have two equally charged objects, they repel each other if you get them close.
The screened Coulomb should diverge.
That's between two point objects. This is a plane.
Still.
Plane and sphere.
A charged plane, a negatively charged plane and a negatively charged sphere. If you get them close, they are repelled.
So when you fit the black squares, you get that potential.
Absolutely. So it completely follows an exponential decay with the bi-length. So
still, it goes to infinity. The counter ions actually would have the opposite effect.
Well, look, I think at the moment none of us is interested. So at the moment we are certain.
Just linearly, you know, it doesn't diverge.
So can we settle the issue?
Yeah, okay.
No, can you say, so first of all, I think at the moment nobody of us is in any way interested what's going to happen upon contact. Because there, this is a different subject, but to say interaction of collider particles with charged surfaces. Here, we only want to avoid that these particles go to the surface and stick there, because then they would no longer be able to explore phase space by Brownian motion. All we need to have is that they stay apart from the wall and are able to do Brownian motion. And when we are interested at distances where these electrostatic forces basically have died out. And therefore, the structure of what's going on here, for the current purposes, is, so to say, not point of interest. They have looked at that for many years, and they know their systems quite well, what they do with these charges. But this is now not of any relevance.
How flat is your surface actually? How flat is the surface?
How flat? Oh, on that, you see, on the scale of the micron, it's totally flat. This is one of the benefits that you use colloidal particles.
Yeah,
you
but don't. You tenth of a micron.
Sure, well, but for experiment, they deal with inhomogeneities maybe on the angstrom level, nanometer level. And this is one of the beauties of using colloidal suspensions, that you get rid of any kind of such kind of inhomogeneity. So for them, it's perfectly flat.
And the spheres are also perfect spheres.
Yes, absolutely. So on this is the beauty. Therefore, we don't use colloids on the nanoscale, but on the micron scale. Because on that scale, we are in absolutely good shape.
What is the magnitude of the screening length for that figure?
Yeah, as I said, so you can see that it's an exponential decay. So I would have to look up the number they have.
Yeah. For the tens of micron.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Further
you
questions on that?
You mentioned, what did you do with Van der Waals? Is this subtracted or it's not?
No, as I said, the choice of the liquid and of the glass is such that the contrast is very small.
And that is true also close to the critical.
Yeah. Yeah, because you are at the critical point, you have no gas-liquid transition, but you have the concentration difference only.
You have, however, big fluctuations.
Sure. That's why you get the turbid system in the first place. Yeah, yeah. But the mean index of refraction is still close to that of the glass. And this implies that here in these tails, you have a not detectable influence by the van der Waals forces. If you look even closer, somewhere they have to appear, sure enough. But on this scale, they are gone.
So we heard a talk like maybe a week or two ago. There was Andy Kim was here, who does experiments on Casimir interactions between neutral or metallic and semiconductor surfaces and dielectrics. Mm-hmm. And he sort of, at least he convinced me that there are big effects of the disordered charge distribution or disordered potential distributions along these surfaces. Mm-hmm. And if you really look at the nitty-gritty details of the force curves, there's lots that could be attributed to these disorder effects, and I'm just wondering whether you ever thought about that in this context. What would be, what would happen if you have patchy surfaces, let's say?
Yes, as I said, if you would now be interested in understanding, to say in detail, this kind of repulsion here, all these issues.
Not just repulsion. If you have patchy surfaces, let's say, with the disorder charge distribution, and you push them together. Of course, the attractive and repulsive interactions are weighted differently because of the Boltzmann distribution. So it's not, the attraction or repulsion will be weighted differently. This is something actually that we might talk about tomorrow. But the disorder effects will be very complicated and can lead also to an effective attraction.
Yeah, but as you can see, say we use, so to say, what is 1 degree above the, below the critical point, we use, so to say, this just as the reference potential. And how this comes about may be a complicated question, and all these details enter. But now the beauty of these critical Casimir forces is that you can switch them on and off. Unless for normal liquids, you have them always there. But here, you are really interested in only the difference. And that means how complicated the background may be. And all these details point towards the fact that there might be important details to worry about. But we are now, at the moment, really only interested what comes on top of that in addition by approaching the critical point. And therefore, for us, we take these kind of potentials now as our baseline and see what builds up on top of them.
You're saying not much is happening to the background in the temperature range which they look at. And
yes.
Are there
experimental proofs of that? Yes. Well, see, you might start to consider questions of what will happen to the salt distribution if you come close to the critical point and you have critical fluctuations. This is an issue we are also looking at in our group. But for the time being, this is not to be seen as a potential threat of analyzing these data. There's no indication on that.
So is the error bar related to this effect, or there are some other effects which introduce larger error bar into the final answer for the Casimir forces? You can probably estimate how big those effects could be, although you don't exactly know the magnitude. The question is whether the error at the end is related to those things or not.
No. So you see, again, these issues about the charges, they are relevant if you are looking at this piece here. If you are looking out there, they are simply gone. They are exponentially down, and therefore they don't contribute. This is, I think...
The main difference to the experiment we heard about by Andy Kim is that he has a vacuum in between the surfaces, and there's no screening of charges, but he has this liquid. Semiconducting surfaces.
Is there a is there a way to calibrate? I mean, you wouldn't have your optics working if you really had index of refraction matching. So you don't have you wouldn't have the evanescent wave if you didn't have an interface. So there is some mismatch that you need in order to see anything. So the simple question is, if you tried a different particle, you try a different solvent, or just try a different, some way to see if the old-fashioned index of refraction mismatch force is significant or not.
So just to give you numbers.
It's a paradox, right? Because you have to make believe the index of refraction.
It's not a paradox. The problem is you have, so to say, you are just optimizing the system. That on one side it works, on the other side it has all the nice features you need in order to succeed in the analysis.
So what's the
let me first put
force?
Yeah, so first of all, so it's 1.384 for the liquid, and this is 1.464 for the glass. These are the numbers.
And maybe just tell us the particle too while we're at it.
The particle is polystyrene.
Yes, yeah, so what's that?
The index of refraction of the particle. I don't know this number offhand. So another number which just to the by length kappa is 12 nanometer.
The size of the particles is?
The size was 2.4 and 3 point something micrometer.
So you have
two different, yep.
And the error in the size is?
They are highly monodisperse. This is, so to say, a preparation art, but they know that very well.
When you compute states of the Hamburger coefficient for these indices of refraction, what do you get? What for the traditional?
Don't know the number now.
This is only the index of refraction for the frequency in which the laser light works. It has nothing to do with any other dielectric constant.
Yeah.
It's only for frequency of the laser.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a difference, and I guess you have enough of a spectrum, you can calculate what the force should be.
Which force?
The traditional, what somebody might call Casimir, or I would call Vanderbilt. Yeah.
But that would be the static.
No, or you just do a whole calculation of the whole frequency spectrum. I mean, you do know polystyrene. You do know over the whole spectrum pretty well. You do know the solvent to some extent over the whole spectrum.
But now this Hamburger constant, I don't have the number now.
But I'm curious why one is assuming that normal charge fluctuation forces are of no consequence here.
Probably.
The point is you have repulsion, but you've got so much charge in there, and you get a very low screening.
But then that only changes that much with the temperature.
For sure he's seeing something with temperature, but what's the secret subtraction, so to speak?
I guess that you go a bit away from the critical point, and you get some sort of curve, and just subtract that from all the other ones.
That's precisely all that.
Any of the other interactions aren't going to change in that small temperature.
Right. No, I think that's for sure.
That's the advantage that this experiment has over.
No, I absolutely vacuum. Take that. Yeah. But I think also it would be good just to try a couple substrates just to see what's sort of in there. Because there are cases where you are seeing traction.
Yeah, but again, you sort of say, I think the whole philosophy is that you want to generate now a reference potential which is repulsive at short distances in order that the particle doesn't stick there and cannot perform Brownian motion, and that it falls off sufficiently fast so that at decent distances you are basically force-free. And now you just experimentally check whether this potential you have generated performs like that. And the data say yes. And now we run, change the temperature, and look what comes in addition to that.
Yeah,
so I think that is the overall.
We have a hard timeline of colloquium,
So I finished now one slide. I finished one slide.
I hope that there is only half slide remaining.
Well, look. We can keep going for a while. So
just till next week.
Yeah. So I'm prepared. Okay. So now the point is now comes an interesting chemistry ingredient, namely. The way you prepare chemically the surfaces of the glass and the surfaces of a colloidal particle. And this first set of data are such that both the wall and the particle are hydrophilic, which means they have the same affinity for water. Which means in our language we had introduced yesterday, this means you have parallel surface fields acting, same preference, which means that you expect attractive forces, attractive critical Casimir forces, and sure enough, this is just showing here. So the expectation is indeed for this setup here of surface chemistry, you expect indeed this to happen qualitatively. And now the point to be made is that now these black lines here are the theoretical prediction. And to emphasize it, without any adjustable parameters. This is really a head-on comparison between the data and the theory. what enters here is universal scaling functions and non-universal amplitudes, but they are fixed by the non-universal amplitudes of the bulk. So there you have no room for maneuvering. And of course, the theoretical curves are only able to capture the Casimir contribution when they are in competition with now the repulsive electrostatic forces. Then the theory is no longer applicable.
They are for sphere plate or for two parallel plates?
It turns out that for these distances, the Dayaguin limit is just perfect. So the actual ingredient is the scaling function for the plate geometry, and now extended by Dayaguin approximation for the sphere and the wall. And now you can, of course, perform the other experiment, that you now keep the wall hydrophilic but turn the particle hydrophobic, which means now antagonistic boundary conditions, and there you expect now repulsive Casimir forces, and they are shown here. You see, the black curve is again this reference potential. And you see now vividly how, upon approaching the critical point, to say you really add now repulsion. You see here the potential should be zero, but here it starts really to diverge. And this.
Why are the measured data going up again for large supernovae?
This is noise. This is there. You are so to say losing
the intensity.
Yeah. So here you are getting now in the noise of the data.
So this is far away, but the scale is different. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah.
So
scale is different.
Yeah, here you are at 0.3, and here you are at 0.8. Okay, you know. And again, to emphasize, the full curves are the theoretical predictions without adjustable parameter.
You are measuring here 8 times K Boltzmann T. So it's e to the power minus 8 or something like that.
6.
Ah.
Right.
Where are you going to the particles to turn, change the character of some?
Well, that is treat them with certain acids. So that there is a whole surface technology available how to change from hydrophilic to hydrophobic.
And changing the material that much doesn't change.
No, and the point is that now you get now this repulsion by only modifying the top layer. So you don't have to change the bulk material. So if you have now, if you think in terms of Chalczynski theory, where also by choice of certain materials you can get repulsive dispersion forces, but you accomplish that by having different bulk materials. Here, you can accomplish that just by changing the top layer chemically. I think this is a major advantage.
Can I ask, is this the standardizing model ordinary fixed point?
Yeah.
So it agrees with the critical exponents and everything of that? These theoretical curves encode the critical exponents of the 3D Ising model?
Well, this is the scaling function in this universality class, but the corresponding bulk belongs to the Ising universality class.
The only exponent which would show up is new.
Yeah.
In the correlation lines.
Yeah. So bulk exponents do enter, but in the finite size scaling function, it's the whole function which reflects both the bulk universality class as well as the surface universality class.
There was some argument about whether the universality class of critical opalescence was the mean field one, and Michael Fisher wrote one of the papers on that.
Not
the same.
No. But even in Coulombic one, he finally found the Ising one.
Okay.
For the primitive model. Yeah. But here it's so to say this is standard Ising universality class, no doubt about that.
If you can vary the effective H1, you change the sign, then, I mean, this adds a new length.
Yes, absolutely. So here we have now...
Already in this,
no, they, this is now the case where you have now strong adsorption. Okay. So, and of course, and this is also a subject we are both interested in, is that you can, of course, now design the surface chemistry such that you have intermediate preferences, such that you can go smoothly between hydrophilic and hydrophobic. And therefore, the challenge would be to adjust the chemistry such that you interpolate smoothly between here and here.
Can you also spatially modulate?
Yes. You see, this is still in this folder here.
Can I just a short?
Yeah.
So, Clemens, you probably know, was the guy who showed that a previous experiment by Greer on some other attractive interaction was wrongly interpreted because they didn't take into account dynamic, hydrodynamic.
No, that was not the point. The point was that they just made an error in the optics. It was not a dynamic problem, but the problem was that Greer didn't do optics right. This is a famous story, infamous one. Well, and I think you might understand that now also from the viewpoint of a theoretician, this is satisfying. So I felt good about it, I must say. So you can now ask what happens if you now turn both of them hydrophobic. And what then happens is that you encounter a wetting phenomenon, such that now you have this repulsion, but then at smaller distances, you get, so to say, the particles really stuck, which means that they have formed a wetting layer here, which forms a bridge with the wetting layer on the substrate, and they just attach to each other. So this is what's going to happen.
If you make both hydrophobic, why do you see repulsion?
Well, you see here, this is now off the critical concentration. You are in the phase diagram on the other, on not at the critical point, but you are on the side of the two-phase coexistence regions. So, and that's where you observe now wetting phenomena instead of the critical phenomena. I only wanted to mention that the whole system is not only interesting right at TC, but if you look around in the whole phase diagram, you see a plethora of additional phenomena there. Yeah, now, dear organizers, we have now a severe decision to be made.
Yeah, so we have one constraint, which is a KRTP colloquium at 2.
Yeah.
So then I think we should finish like maybe 20 minutes before that at least. So that would mean we have somewhat more than 10 minutes left. But
we have the option of continuing on Friday.
Yeah, certainly. That would be...
So
same time as today on Friday.
So then I would just show you now another subject, and let's see how far we can get, and then we keep going. I think that might be then the only thing. Well, next part. The idea is what happens now if you have surfaces which are now chemically structured, and chemically structured in terms of stripes. That is, you have stripes where you have hydrophilic parts and other ones where you have hydrophobic parts. And you can pattern both confining substrates. So this is the case where the stripes are just opposing each other with the same affinity, so both are plus, here both are minus, both are plus. Or you have the situation that they oppose each other just off phase, so plus, minus, minus, plus, etc. Or you can have a situation in which one plate is homogeneous and the other one is alternating. And the other situation is that they are alternating but shifted with respect to each other. Which means now that you have not only now access to changes in the strength of the normal Casimir forces, but you now also generate lateral Casimir forces. Now this is just to set the stage to remind you of what's going to happen on homogeneous substrates. Again, this is the case that you have parallel surface fields, which is an attraction. This is this lower curve here as scaling function of the thickness over the correlation length. That's the force, the normal force, and the repulsive one goes like that for anti-parallel ones, and they are within mean field a factor of 4 stronger. Repulsion is a factor of 4 stronger than attraction. Okay, now let's decorate that. So we have our zebra. And I start out with the plus-plus configuration. So plus phases plus, minus phases minus. You have then possibly different stripe width, S plus and S minus, and this is the thickness. And the scaling says then that the normal Casimir force is then decays as this power of distance times the scaling function of thickness divided by correlation length, the ratio of the strip width, and one strip width in relation to the distance between the two walls. Which means now the following, that if your film thickness becomes large, then this scaling function reduces to one which depends only on the ratio of the strip width. And this is plotted here as function of the strip width. And there you have now the opportunity to tune the critical Casimir forces as function of the strip width, such that if the strip width are equal to each other, then the system looks like, from a distance, as if there would be Dirichlet boundary conditions, because now this amplitude vanishes just here. Which means that if you pattern your substrate up and down from a distance, it looks like as it would be just neutral. And that means that this chemical patterning allows you to realize Dirichlet boundary conditions for classical liquids. And remember, they were only realized so far in the helium one, because there the superfluid order parameter doesn't couple on the substrate to the substrate potential. And classical liquids generically have no chance to realize Dirichlet boundary conditions. But here, you can enforce that chemically.
Can this be understood as kind of an average over the
different? Yeah.
Because the wavelengths.
Absolutely. From a distance, it looks like that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Are these curves obtained? These are numerical?
Yes, this is numerical. This is full numerical.
Simulation of Ising?
This is now all mean field 5^4 theory. This is all mean field, and the whole spirit is such that it's in sort of upgraded mean field theory, in the sense that the scaling variables carry the full 3D critical exponents, but the scaling functions are taken within mean field theory. Now, I already mentioned that you now can get lateral Casimir forces if they are now shifted with respect to each other. And this is shown down here. This is the lateral Casimir force as function of the shift in units of the strip width. And what you see here is that the preference of the systems is such that the forces are restoring around here, which means that they want to stay in registry. And if you move away, then you have to work against the force. They want to stay in registry, and moreover, what you see is now that the strength of the lateral Casimir force depends non-monotonically on the distance between the plates. So if the plates are apart from each other, the L is very large. This is this 7 here. The force is practically gone. Now you push the plates closer to each other. The lateral Casimir force builds up, but then reduces again if you get to closer distance. So it's a non-monotonic behavior.
This curve, so the one which looks more like a sine or cosine is at large separations, right?
Yes.
With the smallest, okay.
Yeah.
And the one which has the edges looks more like the profile on the surface is at short separations.
Yeah, so this is at short separations.
Yes.
And then we can, next is this.
Okay.
Then we get to here, and then we go back again.
Yeah, that looks like, I mean, if you would decompose some kind of this chemical structure of the surface, which is step-like, into a
Fourier
series, what you see at large separation is just the lowest node, and it gives a cosine, and then if you go closer, the separation...
The other ones come in.
The higher harmonics are coming, gives you this kind of edge, profile with edge.
Well?
So the flat part, so the red curve, is that not really flat?
Yeah, not really flat, no. So then let me close with another experiment where now Clemens Bechinger did also this one. So what you do is you pattern your substrates with the focused ion beam such that you can really write with nanometer resolution these chemical patterns. And I think this is absolutely nice to look at. So you have particles size 2.4 micrometer. And he has now patterned the substrate, not this here, not in stripes, but in squares. And what you see here are all the substrates carry this square pattern. And up here, each pixel corresponds to a colloidal particle. And you see here that the blue means that there are few of them, and this means there are many of them. And at high temperatures, that means away from the critical point, these colloidal particles are basically all over the place. And now you reduce the temperature. You go from here to here. And the bluish one is where the Casimir force is repulsive, and the pattern one is where it's attractive. And what you see is that these colloidal particles now start to avoid the repulsive pieces and gather on the optimal places. And if you get closer to the critical point, you see, and ultimately here, they all sit on these particles. So you can use these Casimir forces really to collect particles at pre-arranged patterns. And moreover, you can let them loose again just by changing temperature. So you have now an enormous tool in your hand to perform all kinds of structure formations. And so here I think this is one where you see basically with your naked eye Casimir forces at work. And I think this is just nice. You just see them at work. And of course, you can also analyze this more carefully. Now they have also done, of course, the stripes. as we discussed. And now you can quantitatively study this effective potential now also as function of the lateral coordinate. So this is the stripe structure, plus, minus, plus. And you see here, far away from the critical point, you have basically, you do not realize this contrast. And if you get close to the critical point, the particle realizes there is the contrast, and the particles then start to sit here. And here you can see how they, so to say, mainly are sitting there. Sometimes they jump to a neighboring stripe. And you can now analyze carefully the depth here and the shape of these functions, and this is all under intensive investigation. Well, there is still another one to show, the last one, because you see how powerful this thing really gets. So here you see, here you have the chemical step. And what you see here is minus, so this is the attractive one. And here you see these particles really sticking to the surface and basically forming a monolayer. On the right-hand side, what they do is they form now 3D clusters. So you really get here now pyramids of particles. And if you look then closer here, then these Casimir forces, they give rise to the faceting of these colloidal particles sitting there. So you really can now use the Casimir forces basically to sculpture colloidal clusters on surfaces. And you also can form solids like that. And the main advantage is that you can tune colloidal particles interaction also easily by salt and all kind of stuff. But you can't get that out anymore. So once you have put the salt into, it's in. You don't get it out. And this is difficult then to temper a solid to form a crystal without defects. Here, you can, so to say, start to build a crystal and then get away again from the critical point to, so to say, rumble it a little bit and then cool it off again. And so step by step, you can improve the perfection of colloidal crystals just by switching on and off these Casimir forces. And they are, of course, then you have many body interactions there at the critical point, which give them a particular feature. So it's not just ordinary two-pair interactions. And I think this is a nice playground we can work on. So much for Casimir forces in practice. There's that. Well, thanks.
So I would propose